Blog Talk Radio.
From their studio in the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's the Boomer and the Babe Show with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Join Pete and Deborah and their guests as they give voice to 78 million baby boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Now here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
And welcome, everybody. It is the Boomer and the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio. It's Friday, May 4th, 2012. And we are broadcasting from our studios in the Feeding Arizona complex in Youngtown, Arizona, which is also home of the Valley View Community Food Bank, where the food is always free. I always give a word about the Community Food Bank, Valley View Community Food Bank, at the start of every show, and a little news information or news drops, if you will, the fact that they're going to be moving into a big new facility. It's not new. They're going to be moving into a big facility that used to be a Safeway Superstore, if people are familiar with Safeway stores, and they are going to fill that store with all kinds of food bank activities, including a thrift shop, their second thrift shop, as a matter of fact, and they will be able to house all their vehicles over there and serve the community much more efficiently. So they're looking forward to that, and that's going to be about 30 days or so, and anybody that's interested in contributing in any way, shape, or form, be it monetarily, volunteering, or with food, please contact Jesse Ramirez. He is the executive director and founder of the Valley View Community Food Bank, and you can get to him by valleyviewcommunityfoodbank.com. That's valleyviewcommunityfoodbank.com, and Jesse would be more than happy to hear from you and more than happy to take whatever your offering might be, regardless of size or value. Anything, no items, or no offering is too small. And I have Peter's, Deborah's still working on some projects, hopefully finishing some of them up here this week that she's been working on very hard for the last several weeks, as a matter of fact. I want to let everybody know that we do more of this show on the Boomer the Babe radio show. We also have our ebook we do, and in addition to that, we have ebooks that we publish. Beyond that, we now have our online magazine, Boomer Experience Speaks, which is available on our website at boomerandthebabe.com. So please take a look at that. Sign up for the online magazine. Many of our guests and our show hosts also contribute to that magazine, so it's always good information and timely information. What we had today as a guest, we've been doing more health shows lately because it certainly is something that the boomer population is interested in, and we've had some people saying, well, why don't you do more health? So we're doing some more health, and today we have a very special guest. His name is Dr. James O'Brien. Dr. O'Brien is a sepsis expert. And sepsis, I think, is also known as blood poisoning. And it's interesting, as I was reading some of the materials, how prevalent sepsis really can be and how devastating it can be. So with that, welcome to the Boomer the Babe Show, Dr. James O'Brien.
Thank you very much, Pete, for having me on. Just as a way of introduction, as Pete mentioned, I'm an associate professor of medicine at The Ohio State University Medical Center in Columbus, Ohio. I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, as a product of a middle-class family, and went on and did my undergraduate education at DePaul University in Greencastle, Indiana, and then came back to Ohio State for my medical school and my residency in internal medicine, and then went out to Denver, Colorado, and did a fellowship in pulmonary medicine and critical care medicine at the University of Colorado before being recruited back to be on faculty at Ohio State. Professionally at Ohio State, I'm an associate professor, as I mentioned, and spend most of my time taking care of patients who are in the intensive care unit. Probably about 75% of them are actually afflicted with sepsis. And then also direct one of our medical intensive care units and responsible for improving the quality and delivery of care for those patients. When I'm not in the hospital, I wind up being kept busy by my family, including my wife, Kristen, and we have three children, Lucy, Emmett, and Elliot, who keep us busy going from soccer game to soccer game most weekends.
Well, it sounds like you have a pretty full calendar, that's for sure. As far as your your specialty, sepsis. How did you get to that specialty?
It's a terrific question, and I can tell you that coming out of medical school, I had no appreciation for how common and lethal this disease was. I started first appreciating how important this disease was probably when I was in the clinical years of medical school and then more into residency, and I really gravitated towards taking care of people in the intensive care unit. And then once I became an attending physician and had a practice of my own, I was really struck by how many patients I saw with sepsis and how little attention was given to these patients. Sepsis is truly a medical emergency, which we'll talk about over the course of the hour, and yet it's not routinely treated as one. Additionally, I had the misfortune and continue to have the experience of having to explain to families 3 to 4 times a week that their loved one's dying of something that they've never heard of. And so I became very passionate about trying to change that equation, really for selfish reasons, so that I didn't have to continue having that conversation.
Is sepsis a bacterial disease?
So any infection can lead to sepsis. The majority of infections in the United States that lead to sepsis are thought to be bacterial infections. Know that of the cells that are sitting in that chair listening to us today, 90% of them are actually bacterial cells. There are more bacteria in and on us than there are human cells. And those are the bacteria that seem to lead to this response called sepsis. We don't completely understand why one person winds up living the majority of their life without any problems with these bacteria. Some of them actually provide benefit to us. Other people wind up having uncomplicated infections, and then other people progress on to developing this catastrophic consequence of sepsis.
So is it the case that people can have sepsis while their immune system can ward it off, and they never really knew that they had it other than the fact that they felt a little under the weather for a few days?
So your body has what I would describe as basically an army, which is your immune system, to try and fight off infections. And when it works appropriately, what winds up happening is that your body clears the infection, your body goes back to normal. And for a period of time, you may feel lousy like we do when we have colds. That's part of your body feeling that response to the infection. What happens with sepsis is that instead of having that appropriate response, that response becomes inappropriate. And in fact, that response winds up damaging your own tissues and organs. So in a way, what sepsis is it's friendly fire that your body suffers as a result of a response to an infection.
So the natural immunity is then start attacking the organs or the other cells in the body as well. Not doing anything to the sepsis cells? Is that they kind of step aside from the sepsis cells and go to the other stuff?
So it relates to the fact that our immune system doesn't simply use smart bullets to attack these infections. They throw hand grenades, there are landmines, there are nuclear weapons that are used to try and combat infection. And that in and of itself actually can cause a cascade where your immune system becomes stimulated further. So even if there isn't any infection remaining, this damage can continue on. So the vast majority, for example, of people who die of sepsis, it's very difficult to detect continued live bacteria in an infection. Instead, what's happened is generally those bacteria have been killed by the immune system and or the antibiotics the patient has received. It's just that this initial insult, the initial fire that the infection starts, winds up becoming this overwhelming inferno that your body can't put out again.
So is it the case, I guess, as I was on the website, there is a reference to several people that had a urinary tract infection. And the urinary tract infection developed into sepsis. So that seems to be what I was reading. And I have to admit, I didn't spend 3 days on the website, which I could have done easily. But is that one of the weak points where sepsis is commonly found to start?
Any source of infection can lead to sepsis. However, certain sources seem to be more commonly associated with sepsis. So the most common sites of infection that lead to sepsis are infections in the lungs, infections in the urinary tract, and infections in the belly. But an infection anywhere in your body can lead to sepsis. So those are the most common sites that we see it. Why that's the case, we don't completely understand, but part of it may be that there are simply more infections that occur, for example, in your lungs and in your urinary tract. Your lungs, for example, you're constantly exposed to the external environment. You're breathing continuously. And so as a result, you're breathing in things from the outside world that can get down into your lungs. Your lungs have a very complex response of immune cells that live within your lungs to try and keep you from getting infections. But again, if you wind up having an inappropriate response, that then can lead to sepsis. I think there's frequently a misunderstanding that people think sepsis means that there's an infection in your blood. And in fact, only about 30% of the time are we able to find any sort of bacteria or fungus or virus in the person's blood who has sepsis. So an infection in the lungs can create a response that causes you to have problems with your blood pressure dropping low, your kidneys failing, your blood clotting system failing, and it's really a result of the communication in the immune system in intent to fix the infection in the lungs, causing this damage widespread throughout your body.
Are certain people more susceptible to sepsis? I mean, I know that there are certain races or genders of people that are more prone to other diseases. Is that the case with sepsis, or is it quite a wide swath across the population?
The one thing that's very clear is that no person is protected from sepsis. Any person can wind up being affected. And you can certainly see on our website a number of stories from people who are absolutely the picture of health prior to having sepsis affect their lives. However, there are certain patients who appear to be at higher risk. And so you mentioned, for example, there are a number of studies out there that suggest that non-Caucasian races are at higher risk than Caucasian races, that men may be at higher risk than women. We don't understand the reasons for those associations. There are other risk factors that are even more obvious. Of interest to your listening audience, the older we get, the more prone we are to sepsis, such that the risk for people who are over the age of 65 of having a hospitalization associated with sepsis compared to people who are younger is actually of a higher magnitude than your risk for getting lung cancer if you're a current smoker versus if you never smoked. So for reasons we don't completely understand, it may be because the immune system doesn't work as well as we get older. People as we age are much more prone to contracting sepsis. The other group is the extreme of age is the very young. So newborn children are also very prone to sepsis. And sepsis actually kills more children in this country than cancer does. But worldwide, if you look in the developing world, sepsis is one of the major killers of children, killing maybe as many as 7 million children every year, mostly through diarrheal illness and pneumonia. The other big risk factors that seem to be associated with the risk of sepsis are associated with some underlying medical conditions. So sepsis is a major killer of cancer patients. The vast majority of people with cancer don't die of their underlying cancer. They die of complications from their cancer or from the treatment, and sepsis is a major player in that. It's a particularly deadly disease for people who have leukemia and lymphoma. And I work at a place that has a comprehensive cancer center, and we see patients who are in their battle with cancer, and their battle winds up being interrupted by sepsis. We see those patients almost every day. Wow. People who are on medications that affect your immune system, like corticosteroids, people who are on medications that might be used to treat rheumatoid arthritis or inflammatory bowel disease, people with HIV, people with liver disease, and people with alcohol dependence, so alcoholism or people who have had problems with alcohol withdrawal also seem to be at higher risk. The last group that seems to be at higher risk are people who live their lives with chronic indwelling devices, particularly, for example, catheters that go into the bloodstream. And those catheters might include catheters that are used for people to be able to undergo infusions of chemotherapy or to undergo hemodialysis. There probably are other risk factors as well, but we just haven't identified them yet because we have not paid as much attention to understanding this disease as we have other diseases that are more well-known to the public.
So when a doctor says that they're, I have some familiarity with the the dialysis situation. But when a doctor says you have to beware of infection at the site, that's what he's really referring to, isn't it, is sepsis?
He is referring to sepsis because the difference between an uncomplicated infection and sepsis is really the life-threatening nature of it. When people die of infection, 99% of those deaths are due to sepsis, because what sepsis is it's this life-threatening condition when the infection causes you to have damage to your tissues and organs. And so in order for an infection to become life-threatening, it really needs to progress to sepsis. Doctors, however, find it very, very difficult to communicate about this disease. And a survey done within the last 10 years of physicians suggested that only about 10% of the time do we even use the word. 80% of the time we instead describe sepsis as a complication from some underlying condition, a complication from cancer, a complication from pneumonia, a complication from an infection from a dialysis catheter.
So the description of the malady has in great part to the misunderstanding or lack of understanding of the malady, because it's not addressed as what it is.
I agree with you, Pete. I think that that is a huge area that we're trying to combat. We actually conduct at Sepsis Alliance a annual telephone survey of Americans, and we ask them simply, have you ever heard of sepsis? And we're very encouraged by the fact that this number has gone up every year. But last year, only 41% of Americans had even heard of the word. If instead you start looking at, well, if you've heard of the word, can you provide any sort of definition? 69% of Americans either have never heard of sepsis or can offer no suggestion about what it might be. And so there's a huge lack of awareness. We're trying to change that so it's easier then for physicians and patients to communicate about this disease so that we can have a greater awareness and the public has a greater expectation for improved care.
Is the word sepsis at all related to or derivative from the word septic?
Absolutely it is. And you'll hear sepsis, septic, septicemia, septic shock, severe sepsis. These are all forms of the same disease that we're discussing.
Okay.
In general, septic is used more as an adjective, while sepsis is used more as the noun.
So, in other words, he is septic.
That's exactly right.
And indicating that he or she has that disease, this individual is septic.
Now, that is correct.
What is the disease? And I had it on the tip of my tongue, and it slipped. If you go in for surgery, you come out, and the surgical or whatever may become infected.
Mm-hmm.
What is that termed?
So a surgical site infection is generally what we're terming it then, and that can occur in a variety of places. So, for example, if you have surgery on part of your body that is normally has bacteria in it, for example, your bowels, you can actually get an infection inside your abdomen, which can lead, or inside your belly, which can lead to sepsis. Or alternatively, because your skin is covered with bacteria, when we make that incision can actually get infected as well. And so you can get what we would call a skin and soft tissue infection that can lead to sepsis also.
Mm-hmm. It seems as though it's kind of like that old line from back in the day, they're everywhere. It's kind of like sepsis, it's everywhere. No matter where you turn, it's a potential problem.
It is startling when you start looking at the numbers, particularly when there's this big difference between the number of cases of sepsis and the number of cases. There are approximately 1.7 million hospital admissions every year in the United States due to sepsis. That's a hard number to get your head around. Basically, what that means is that one out of 185 Americans will be hospitalized in the next year with sepsis. So think about your group of friends. If you do social media and you're on Facebook, think about how many Facebook friends you have and start thinking about the averages and what number that affects. As we talk to more and more people about this disease, what you'll find is they'll say things like, oh, you know what? I had an uncle. And he had pneumonia, and he wound up dying. Do you think that was sepsis? So people start making these connections. They at first can't believe that the numbers are what they are, because otherwise they would have heard about this disease. And that's one of the things we're trying to combat, is making this more recognizable to folks, because we think that by bringing this awareness forward, it's going to enable us to have greater impact on the disease.
Earlier, when you were talking, you said that people don't die necessarily of whatever. It's the underlying, there's a cause beyond that. Kind of like my father didn't die of Alzheimer's. He died of conditions related to Alzheimer's. It wasn't the Alzheimer's that killed him, per se. The Alzheimer's precipitated other things. So how do you pin this thing down? I mean, if somebody is obviously struggling, how do you pin it down? What are the tests for? Is it a blood test?
It's a great question. So the first thing we start with, just like with any diseases, or any disease, is starting with the notion of the signs and symptoms a patient might have. The difficulty is that sepsis doesn't have a single set of signs and symptoms. And so because of that, we have to be constantly suspicious of this in patients who are acutely ill. When we talk to survivors, the only common theme that seems to exist among sepsis survivors is they mention that their symptoms were the worst they'd ever had. So they felt the worst they'd ever had. They had the worst sore throat. They were the most short of breath. We tell people to be concerned about sepsis when it feels different than when you have a cold. And, you know, we've all had a cold where you feel lousy and you're in bed and you don't feel like doing much, but you don't have things like, I'm lightheaded when I get up, or my skin looks mottled, or I'm not making any urine, one of the things I hear a lot from families is, you know, we went to sleep 2 days ago and we just couldn't wake him up. So confusion or alterations in someone's level of consciousness where they're in a coma, those are things that we look out for. When we get patients to the hospital, again, there's unfortunately not a single laboratory test that tells us that someone has sepsis. Strictly speaking, sepsis is defined by the belief that someone has an infection and the fact that they have signs that this is affecting their whole body. They have a fast heart rate, they're breathing fast, their temperature is abnormal, their white blood cell count is abnormal. And then we start looking for, is the sepsis affecting their organ systems at all, causing organ failure? But the short answer is that unfortunately we don't have a single diagnostic test like an electrocardiogram or an EKG or even a blood test like is used for heart attacks like a troponin. And we desperately need that because that would help us to sort out what infection someone might have, what antibiotics are most likely to help. To do that, we need better research. We need better funding of this disease, which really comes from the public demanding better care and better outcomes.
If somebody has a history of some issues, myself as an example, back in 1984, I had valley fever. It's clear, I mean, I've spent, I don't know how long, taking the therapy, intravenous therapy for it. I mean, 3 times a week, it was miserable stuff. And that's not even chemotherapy. I dread to think what people with chemotherapy have to go through for cancer. But does that have a lingering effect then? And is that a point at which could open the door to something like a sepsis?
The short answer is we don't know. And I will tell you that the most difficult question I get from sepsis survivors is, am I at risk of having sepsis again? And the short answer is we just do not know. We desperately need better information. We have yet to have a population-based study looking at people to see what are their risk factors for developing sepsis going forward. The data that we have is really all based on hospitalized patients and mostly looking at billing records. So there's a lot of information that we need to learn about this disease to be able to answer those questions. Assuredly, one of the things that occurs as a basis of us having different genetic backgrounds is we have different responses to infections. A lot of scientists propose that that's actually why we combine our genes in different ways by having sexual reproduction. that is to battle infectious diseases, to keep our genetic variability up. But the short answer is we don't have a great understanding of that currently.
So you mentioned some of the signs of sepsis. Are there any others that are less pronounced? The earliest possible sign.
It really can start as anything, and it can also progress at different rates. And some of that may depend on how frail the person is otherwise. You can imagine that if someone has a lot of medical problems, isn't terribly functional, that it may not take that severe a case for people to show signs and symptoms and for us to notice the difference. But if you take a 23-year-old who's otherwise healthy, they may be able to tolerate a lot of their body being damaged without them really showing signs. And I've had the misfortune of taking care of some patients who were young who sat at home getting sicker and sicker, not knowing, because the vast majority of the time in those folks, they have a cold and they're going to get better. A lot of the symptoms are associated with where the infection might be. So if someone has a urinary tract infection, they may have burning when they urinate or a change in the color or a change in the smell of the urine they have. For people who have pneumonia, they may have a cough where they're bringing up either phlegm or even bloody phlegm. They may have fever. They may have chest pain. Unfortunately, there's not any single sign or symptom. I think that the things that we tell people to worry about is when you think that this is outside of the norm. And some of those things, again, are things like confusion or lightheadedness. Or if things just don't feel right, that's a time to say I'm concerned about sepsis. We don't ask patients to try and diagnose if their chest pain is a heart attack or not. You can't do it. But we tell them to be worried enough about it, and we have stuff to offer those folks that you need to get checked out. And that's really the same thing with sepsis.
And if you Google something, you will have every symptom that's that ever shows up. I mean, you look at sepsis, and it says, you know, some of the warning signs as an example. That say it might be sepsis or something else. And some of the warning signs are this. Is, well, I feel that way. My gosh, I feel that way. And all of a sudden, you've got yourself dying. You know.
Well, and I agree with you, Pete. And one of the difficult things is that we are so early in our understanding of this disease that we're lumping almost assuredly a bunch of different diseases together and labeling them all sepsis. Because the 19-year-old who has influenza with sepsis is probably a whole lot different than the 80-year-old who has a urinary tract infection with sepsis. But we call them the same thing. So
right.
The analogy I would use is if you Googled the signs and symptoms of cancer, you would also get an entire list of things.
Absolutely.
And we need to do better to start figuring out the different types of diseases that exist within sepsis so we can start giving people better information about the signs and symptoms, the tests we should be doing, and the therapies for these patients.
Well, are there any tests that are the baseline tests? And I know you mentioned the blood cell, white blood cells and elevating and so on and so forth and heart rate. So I guess you can test those. But I mean, is there anything else that you always use as a test for sepsis?
I would say that in general, what occurs is that if you come to the emergency department, for example, and the physician is or the patient is concerned about sepsis, the things that we're going to do include assessing your blood counts, looking at some of the chemistries in your blood, and looking for signs of some of your organs not working. The organs that tend to be affected by sepsis include the lungs, it includes the brain, it includes your blood pressure, it includes the kidneys, it includes the blood clotting system, and it can include your liver function. Why those organ failures occur, we don't completely understand, and it probably depends on the patient and where they are in their course. So we will check laboratory tests looking for the function of those organs. We also will assess where the infection might be coming from. So we may get an x-ray of the chest. We may get a urine sample and look for signs of infection there. We'll get blood cultures to see if there happens to be one of the few, you know, one of the 30% of cases where your blood cultures actually tell us that you have an infection in your bloodstream. The other things that are done at times is measuring something called your lactate. lactate is a byproduct that your tissues make when they don't get enough oxygen. One of the things that happens with sepsis for a variety of reasons is the tissues don't get enough oxygen delivered to them and can't handle them well. And so as a result, your cells shift to a process by which they are able to still produce energy, and a byproduct that they produce is lactate. And so that's something that is sometimes used as a marker for possible sepsis, or at least identifying patients who are at risk for bad things happening. There are some other tests that are used less universally. There's a test called procalcitonin, which tends to be a marker of people with severe bacterial infections. May not be as useful for looking at people with viral infections and with fungal infections. And we're getting a new group of tests that hopefully are going to be coming along over the next 5 years or so, which hopefully will give us a better sense of trying to identify sooner what infection someone might have, which might help us to know better what sort of antibiotics to use.
You said you have some tests coming along maybe over the next 5 years or so. What is the process, and why does it take so long? I mean, 5 years to me seems like a long time with all the knowledge and everything that we have. And I think there's other folks along the way that would say it takes so much longer here than it does in Europe to get these things approved. Why does it take so long for the test, or why does it take so long for the new medication? Whereas sometimes people, if they are fortunate enough to have the wherewithal, can go to Europe or go wherever else and get the tests or the drugs, and it may or may not work for them, but nonetheless, there's anecdotal evidence at any rate enough to cause them to go. What's the reason for the wait?
I think that's a complex question, and I think that most of my answer here is going to be opinion rather than certainty. But I think that the Food and Drug Administration is in a position of the intent being to protect the public, and that tends to take the mode of they would rather require a higher level of certainty that something is appropriate before approving than might exist in Europe. And some of that comes from the outrage that we have as the public if something winds up being approved that down the road is shown to have side effects. If you look at, for example, the outcry that followed the COX-2 inhibitors, which were an arthritis drug that after being approved was shown to increase risks of things like strokes and heart attacks, there was great outcry, and there certainly were great lawsuits as well. And so I think sometimes we as a population expect perfection. And if we're going to have this high of standards, then we understandably then wind up setting up a regulatory situation where they are very reluctant to approve things. It's also difficult, I think, particularly in the sepsis area, because the provision of care is variable. And so as a result, when you do these studies, there's a lot of noise in the system. And so trying to figure out what matters, whether this molecule is abnormal because it's actually associated with people doing worse with sepsis, or whether it's just associated with us having provided worse care, is difficult to know. And so because of the way we approach this disease, it makes the science much more difficult as well. And then there's always just the usual difficulty of being able to conduct these studies. It takes a long time to do these studies and have patients in them. We don't have a universal process as some countries do where the expectation is people are going to participate in medical research. We leave that to the individual to decide.
Right.
Part of what I do in my job is actually do clinical research. And we have a fair number of people who say, this isn't for me.
Right.
That immediately winds up lengthening the time it takes to understand and conduct the science.
Well, yeah, I can understand that. I can see how that would happen. It's kind of like this thing that just happened in the news with this football player with regard to concussions in the National Football League.
Mm-hmm.
There are now these football players. It's unfortunate that he ended his life the way he did, but the fact is now they're looking at these brains to see if there are issues there, and it does take a while. I can understand that, and it'd be nice if people would will their body to science, so to speak. Is that something?
And some people do. Generally, that's a process that occurs after you die, which obviously doesn't help us a great deal with these studies. And instead, we very much emphasize, obviously, in this country, the notion of autonomy. that people have the right to decide for themselves what's appropriate.
Sure.
These studies are very difficult in sepsis because a lot of times these patients are not able to provide that information themselves because they're sick, they may be confused, they may be in a coma, they may be on life support, and so it's more complex because now we have to go and approach family members and see if they'd be interested in enrolling their loved one in a study at a time when they are the most emotionally fragile in their entire lives.
Exactly.
It makes it very difficult. It makes it very difficult, and it's difficult for families to decide that.
Sure. Is it possible for somebody to be carrying around the sepsis bacteria, for lack of a better word, I guess? Maybe I don't know if I'm using it properly or not, but carrying around the sepsis, and it's just there. It's dormant. Nothing's really happening. And then they have need for a procedure of some sort, maybe even minor, and all of a sudden that just triggers it. And here it comes. It's just an onset now.
The majority of infections that lead to sepsis are ones that come from organisms that live on and in us on a daily basis. So I'd agree with you. Something happens, and we don't understand always what that something is. And it may be something as easy as, for example, you know, you have a cut, and your skin, what it does is it serves to protect the inside, your body, from the outside, the rest of the world. And
right.
So when you have that cut, if bacteria wind up getting in there and your body doesn't respond to it appropriately, that absolutely can lead to sepsis. So it's actually uncommon infections that you get from elsewhere that lead to this. Influenza can do this. So the influenza outbreaks that occur every year and the pandemics that we see, those are infections that you catch that don't normally live inside your body. And that's why we take those patients when they're in the hospital and we place them into isolation to prevent them from spreading that infection.
Gotcha.
But the vast majority of patients that we have with sepsis, we don't put them on isolation because the nurses and doctors caring for them and the families who are visiting them have those same bacteria living on their skin or living inside their body. And so we need to have a better understanding of what is that tipping point? What causes someone to go from leading an existence with these bacteria in and on them to having an infection that leads to sepsis?
So now you've got somebody with sepsis that's under your care. How do you treat that? How do you treat sepsis?
So the great part about this disease, so I've mentioned a number of scary things, how common this is. One thing we didn't talk about is this disease kills about 258,000 Americans every year. To give a context for that, that's more people than die of breast cancer, prostate cancer, and lung cancer combined. That's someone dying every 2 minutes in this country of sepsis.
Unbelievable.
The great hope, however, is that we actually have treatments that can prevent the vast majority of deaths that currently occur available to us now. So if you want to cure cancer, you need billions of dollars and decades because we've been at this for a long time. But this is a disease where we actually could change the natural history of this disease in the next 5 years. And the primary aspects of therapy for this disease are using appropriate antibiotics and giving people the administration of fluids by vein. By appropriate antibiotics, what I mean by that is antibiotics that should take care of the bacteria or fungus or virus that would wind up causing the infection. So, for example, if someone comes from the community and has a pneumonia, there's a list of recommendations as far as antibiotics that should be appropriate to take care of that infection. What we know is that with the most severe form of sepsis, where your blood pressure is low, something called septic shock, for every hour that passes without appropriate antibiotics, your risk of dying goes up by 8%.
Wow.
So this is truly a time-sensitive disease. Most hospitals, however, aren't routinely measuring how long it takes them to get antibiotics into patients with septic shock because it's not something that the federal government knows about. It's not something the public knows about. And so as a result, you've got individual practitioners within hospitals, and you've got some hospitals who have made tremendous progress in this disease, but it's not a universal situation. And that's really the hope of this disease, is that what we estimate is that if we got every person in this country with septic shock antibiotics within 2 hours, which should be doable. Every hospital has these antibiotics. We would wind up saving about 32,000 lives every single year.
Amazing. Amazing. It's just kind of like everybody, medical people are seem to be so focused on if you're having a stroke, you have to do this within a certain length of time to minimize the effects or eliminate the effects of a stroke. If you're having a heart attack, you can stop the heart attack by administering these drugs or whatever the case might be, but it's not the case with sepsis.
And that's what we're trying to change. Because, again, the promise, the hope with this disease are the thousands of lives that could be saved as a result of using exactly those blueprints. What you just described, those diseases, stroke, heart attack, cardiac arrest, people's heart stopping, and major accidents, people having trauma, those are medical emergencies. And we treat them saying this is a time-sensitive disease, we need to act on it right now, and we need to bring the specialists to where the patients are to provide the care and not wait. And that's exactly the model. Some hospitals that have done this have dropped the mortality from people with septic shock from 50%, one out of two patients dying, down to 10%, just by organizing their approach to providing this care.
Amazing. So, I mean, the key then is to have a rifle shot approach rather than a shotgun blast approach.
It's certainly to have a more pointed approach to providing this care as opposed to, I think what happens too commonly is, if you present into an average emergency department, providing that care is going to be on the backs of the nurse and the emergency room physician who also are busy taking care of a lot of other folks. However, if a patient comes in with a heart attack, that patient's going to be whisked away to the heart catheterization lab and cared for by the cardiologist immediately. Mm-hmm. So what we're saying is we're bringing more resources, better structure to provide care for these patients, and that's what we need to aim to do for sepsis.
I look back now at an incident where my father had a cut or some sort of a problem on his leg, and it turned, I do believe they said it turned septic.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to put him in the hospital. Of course, he wouldn't go to the hospital. But the doctor said, I will let you go home as long as you take this heavy dose of whatever this was at the time. This is many years ago. And keep that leg elevated and so on and so forth. And he survived it. It was fine. So apparently it wasn't as to the immense degree that we're talking about here. But it seems that there are so many drugs nowadays that have the drug itself, we're going to give you this, whatever it is, and it has many different antibiotics in it, all contained in there. And because a physician chooses the right drug that has the right mixes and multitudes of antibiotics in it, it goes a long way to helping whatever is being taken care of. Is that the case? Am I expressing that properly?
Tell me if I'm answering your question or not, Pete.
Okay.
When we look at whether or not people get appropriate antibiotics and the delays in appropriate antibiotics, about 80% of that delay is just our lack of organization in making this an emergency, that those antibiotics have to go in as soon as possible.
Right.
And some of that comes from the way that patients present. I heard a colleague say once that if sepsis was associated with a gene where patients screamed out in pain until they received antibiotics, we wouldn't have this problem.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the case. With a heart attack, that's exactly what happens. The person has chest pain, they feel lousy, the EKG gets bad, the doctor treats it appropriately, and that all gets better. So they get the feedback that what they're doing is the right thing as well. About 20% of the delay is actually doctors choosing the wrong antibiotics. And we have national guidelines, and a lot of hospitals have recommendations based on kind of their local bacteria that they have, suggesting which antibiotics should be used for which infections. For my part, I think that it's a tragedy that we still leave this to making sure the doctor makes the right choice, as opposed to the default being that the right choice is made. So one of the things we've done at Ohio State is actually created basically a pathway where all the doctor has to do is say, this person's an ICU patient, they're allergic to penicillins, and I think they've got pneumonia, and the right antibiotic choices are immediately ordered, as opposed to me having to think about each time the right thing to do. If you want something that it occurs frequently to be done the correct way over and over again, you don't want to leave it to the variation of individual brains. You want that to be something that's done right every time.
Yes, that is basically answering my question. Thank you. Because I had this vision. Somebody comes in and they present with whatever the case is, and the physician knows that they're in need of antibiotics, and they look up on the shelf, and there's this antibiotic that takes care of this group of diseases, and this antibiotic that takes care of this group of diseases, and another one over here that takes up a third group of diseases. Now, which one do I choose?
Right.
That's kind of what I was getting at, yes.
And they're experts in this area. The infectious disease doctors are experts at saying, you know what, it looks like both of these antibiotics should work, but this one's actually better. Mm-hmm. Personally, I wind up busy with a lot of other stuff, and I would rather the experts say to me, use these, and that the simplest thing to do is the right thing to do, so that I can make sure that my patients get the care they need each time, and I can move on to the other things that I have to do for these patients.
Right, right. Can sepsis be prevented?
In some instances, yes. So the things that I would recommend to people as far as preventing sepsis. So first of all, getting appropriate immunizations. Flu vaccines, pneumonia vaccines, meningitis vaccines. Those have been shown to dramatically decrease the risk of severe infections. So even if you wind up with, for example, a pneumonia, that it's going to be less severe than if you'd have not gotten the vaccination. So that would be the first thing. The second thing is that if you are in a hospital or a healthcare facility, don't let anyone touch you, or if you're you have a family member who's in the hospital, don't let anyone touch them who hasn't washed their hands yet. We have a very difficult time even now in healthcare reliably washing our hands. It's just it's difficult to remember to do that because you're doing so many other things and there's no immediate consequence to you not washing your hands. And so we need those helpful reminders to make sure that that occurs. Those are the major things that we have to offer people as far as preventing infections. Hospitals have other things, and there's been a greater emphasis on preventing hospital-acquired infections, which are a cause of sepsis amongst hospitalized patients. And there have been some significant successes, and hospitals have been committed to reducing ventilator-associated pneumonia and central line-associated bloodstream infections, and so there's a great deal of promise in doing that as well. The problem is that we still have a lot of patients who present to us through the emergency department who contracted their infections not in the hospital, that we don't have a clear understanding of how we might have prevented them. And again, that's an area where we need to understand this disease better and have better science so that we can prevent these events from occurring in the first place.
The use of antibiotics, how frequently is it the case now where an antibiotic, there's an immunity to an antibiotic? Because there just seem to be so many different antibiotics, and if people use the same one over and over again, I hear that you can develop an immunity to the antibiotic. Is it best to use antibiotics only when they're absolutely necessary, or do you use them for every whip-stitch little thing that you got going?
So the immunity is actually resistance that develops amongst the bacteria and fungi and viruses. It's not your body becoming immune to it, but this is clearly a problem, and more in our country than other countries. We have a lot bigger problem with what's called antibacterial resistance than occurs in other countries. And I think that if you looked at press reports, you hear a lot more reports about the overuse of antibiotics and superbugs than you hear about delays of antibiotics and needless deaths from sepsis. And there's no doubt that we need to be more effective in our choice of administration of antibiotics. Most of the data suggests that patients who present to an outpatient facility with a cold, where it's diagnosed as a cold, 20% of them still get antibiotics, even though we know that antibiotics don't work for colds. Antibiotics don't have much of an effect for inner ear infections for kids or much of an effect for acute sinusitis. and yet we demand antibiotics in those instances. I've heard numbers also that somewhere between 40 to 60% of the antibiotics used in this country are actually used on the livestock population. So there are areas that we need to get better in using antibiotics. However, what we're talking about is sick people coming to the hospital with an infection. And those are folks who need antibiotics. We need to be able to customize their antibiotics as we get more information. So as if we have, for example, their urine, they have a urinary tract infection and the urine culture will get results over the course of a day to 2 days. And if that shows that people don't need what we would call broad-spectrum antibiotics, one of these big-gun antibiotics that treat lots of infections, we should change their antibiotic to one that's narrower, that will just treat that infection to reduce the risk of infection. So there's work that we have to do, but what we're doing right now is we're giving these patients with sepsis antibiotics, but we're giving them to them late, which causes them to be more likely to die. And if they don't die, they're going to be sick longer and probably be exposed to more antibiotics, driving a higher likelihood of them developing this resistance. So what we're doing overall is just an inefficient way of managing our antibiotic stock.
Yeah, I can see that. It's very plain to see the way you've explained it, that the efficiency is probably as much an issue as anything else.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at your site here, and there are a lot of people that are shown as survivors, and there's others, obviously, that have passed on. What happens to those sepsis survivors? I mean, do they have lingering effects from sepsis from that day forward?
This is something that we're just beginning to understand, and we need to pay a great deal more attention to. And I myself have really only started to understand this since my involvement with Sepsis Alliance and since we've started collecting these stories of sepsis survivors. Probably the largest study that's been done so far looked at a specific complication for patients who were sepsis survivors. It looked at people who were in their 50s who started in this study and were followed over the course of about 20 years. And they compared patients who were hospitalized with sepsis and survived to patients who are hospitalized for other reasons and survived. You'll like to know also that the study was done at the University of Michigan and still a very valid study in my opinion. But what it showed is amongst survivors of sepsis compared to the survivors hospitalized for other reasons, whether it's heart failure or heart attack or whatever, that those patients were more likely to have limitations in their activities of daily living. So that's things like the ability to bathe themselves, dress themselves, feed themselves. And they were much more likely to develop a syndrome called moderate or severe cognitive impairment. And what that generally describes is problems with what we call executive functions, the ability to calculate, the ability to concentrate on items, some issues as far as probably spatial relationships, so navigating maps, memory issues. And the neurologists might argue about this, but an easy way of thinking about this is these are people who develop some form of dementia following their sepsis. And based on this study and looking at national estimates, there may be as many as 20,000 Americans every year who develop this cognitive dysfunction following sepsis. When I talk to individual sepsis survivors, they describe a whole multitude of what, from a physician standpoint, would be very bizarre complaints. I had dinner with a young woman who's a sepsis survivor who described her sense of smell being completely different than it used to be. The foods she likes to eat are completely different than it used to be. In her instance, she's actually much better at math than she was prior to her episode. A lot of people describe problems with fatigue. They describe problems with the ability to concentrate. I had one woman who was describing to me that she couldn't concentrate long enough to fill out her disability paperwork. These people are going back and following up with their general doctors with these complaints, and the doctors have no idea that this may be linked to the sepsis. And it's because a lot of these patients are critically ill in the ICU where I work, and I consider it a success that you survived, and I send you on your way, and I don't see you again. And we need to have better follow-up and continuity of care of these patients to better understand what are these chronic complications after sepsis, and most importantly, how can we restore people's function?
Well, when somebody has had a bout with cancer and they've had either surgically or chemotherapy or radiated or whatever, and there seems to be no longer a case of cancer going on, they still come back every so often on a periodical basis, every 6 months or whatever it is, for 5 years or whatever that prescribed treatment is, but they still are followed up with it. And it seems like, I think that you're probably very, very right that the same thing should be done with sepsis, seeing as how it kills as many people, if not more people, than cancer.
That's exactly right. And I think that one of the things that, again, can help to drive this change is the public coming with expectations. If you look at how we've made progress in any disease, and whether you look at the way that HIV has changed over the last 30 years, or if you look at breast cancer survivorship, that didn't come from the healthcare changing things. That came from the public raising awareness, demanding better, expecting better, and responses from the government that facilitated the environment so that healthcare was able to make these changes. But it doesn't come from the inside out. And that's one of the major reasons that we try to engage the public, is because we think that that's really the solution that's going to create the environment so that healthcare will change. Because we need to approach this from a system level. A single well-meaning person in healthcare can't affect this, because these patients occur throughout the entire continuum of healthcare. And so what we need an approach that comes from a system level that requires things like administrators saying this is a priority for us. And for many of them, it's not on their radar either, because it's not one of the things the public cares about or asks about.
What can somebody that wants to help and wants to get involved in maybe changing some of these practices or create more awareness, what can they do to help?
So, again, the great part about this disease is there's a lot that they can do to help. Sepsis Alliance is absolutely a grassroots volunteer organization, and we're constantly looking for people who are passionate about this and want to change the world. And that's truly what we have the capacity to do. The first thing I would do is you can say sepsis. So by using the word, we help to raise awareness. And we encourage people to do that every chance they get. And we find that, you know, people go and get their hair cut and they start talking with their barber about something, and they'll find that, you know, the barber had someone that they knew about who had sepsis. We ask people to share their stories of how they've encountered this, because what we also know is that one of our problems with this disease is it's seen as numbers and not faces. And we need to put a face to this disease. That is what causes us to care. When we see in these stories our own children, when we see in these stories our own spouse, and that's what drives us to change. We ask people to also suspect sepsis. So if you're worried because you're having symptoms that are out of the ordinary, we tell people to go to healthcare and say, I'm concerned about sepsis, because that triggers for me as a physician a specific question you're asking that I have to respond to. And so we think that that can help this as well. And I think that that will help to drive the situation where healthcare can respond and provide better care. So I think there's a great deal that people can do. I would encourage folks who are interested to go to our website at sepsisalliance.org. You also can read stories of sepsis survivors and memorials of patients who have died of sepsis at facesofsepsis.org as well. And if you're interested in participating in what we're doing, there are plenty of opportunities to contact us, and we can help to facilitate and get you materials so you can help to spread the word as well.
Now, you have a Twitter page also, don't you? What is it? At sepsis?
At Sepsis Alliance, and we're also on Facebook as well as Sepsis Alliance.
Okay, all right. Yes. Either way, so at Sepsis Alliance for Facebook and Twitter.
That's exactly right. And through the website, you also can obviously sign up for the Twitter or Facebook feeds as well. So we utilize social media a great deal, just like Boomer and the Babe do.
Yeah, absolutely. Doctor, I'm speechless. I'm not often speechless, but I am today. I knew of it based on the fact that I'd heard of it before, but what it entails is way beyond what I thought it was. I mean, I thought it was, you got a blood infection to give you some antibiotics. It's much more than that. And I'm really glad that you were here with me today and giving all this information out to our listeners. And I hope people listen to this thing all over and over and over again. So I think it'd be
well,
great.
Well, Pete, we appreciate the opportunity to participate, and the thing I can say confidently is giving a voice to those who are suffering from sepsis and those that will absolutely is something that will result in lives saved. So I really want to thank you for giving us this opportunity.
Well, it was my pleasure. I've got a phone number here for you that came up on my board. If I call that phone number immediately after the show, will I be able to get to you?
I don't know what the phone number is, but it's entirely possible.
Well, the last four digits are 5,000.
No, the last four digits would be 0582.
0582. I'll call you right after the show.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Dr. O'Brien, Dr. James O'Brien, sepsis expert extraordinaire. We're certainly in your debt for being with us today and talking about this devastating disease that people really don't fully understand, and you're going a long way to help them do that. So we appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
Thank you now. You've been listening to the Boomer the Babe show here on Blog Talk Radio. We have shows that we do every Monday through Friday from 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock Pacific time, where we try to bring you good conversation to the world. Today we brought you a conversation with Dr. James O'Brien about sepsis. You can listen to the Boomer the Babe show, as I said, every Monday. Next week, we're going to have some pre-recorded shows up, so you can listen to those. Remember, we do much more than host this radio show on Blog Talk. Check us out at boomerandthebabe.com. See everything that makes up the Boomer the Babe Incorporated. Be sure to make the second half of your life the best half of your life. Have a great weekend, everybody. Cinco de Mayo. Enjoy Cinco de Mayo, but enjoy it safely. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you next week.
Boomer the Babe show, where we bring interesting conversations to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as Pete Peters 47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.